everybody, and welcome to episode 17 of Here We Go Again, Israeli Politics. Secretary of Defense holds Israel hostage for money. Ultra-Orthodox community, the Haredis, get a good deal. Israeli soldier shot, and Bennett flies to the States amid a political mess. Economics discussion, and fun Israel facts of the week. This is Here We Go Again.
As part of the budget dealings in the past few weeks, Minister of Defense Gantz has been holding the country and the budget of the country hostage for a certain amount of money for the budget of defense. Now, we discussed this last week, but a few new things were published about this. For example, one of the things that he's been holding out for is 1.5 billion shekel for pensions for the higher officers in the army.
So before we get into the depths of this specific issue, can you give us a bit of a broader explanation of why the budget is so important? Why is it important now? How does it affect the political system?
Yeah, so Israel's been functioning without a budget for around 2.5 years, give or take. What this means is that each year they take the budget from the previous year, divvy it up by 12, and that's the money you have for that month. You can't do any long-term projects and such things because there's no money for it, essentially.
Don't you have to pass a budget?
So, it's a little more complicated than that. In Israel, there is a law that you have to pass a budget. But if there's no budget passed, that's what happens. In this specific government, in the bylaws of this government, there was a clause that stated that they had to pass a budget within the first 3 months, or this government automatically falls apart, and they go to elections. That is the, without, no one can stop it unless they go to another vote, which in the previous government, we might add, they had a similar clause and they just pushed it off by a vote. They have around a month and a half left, although we mentioned recently that the Knesset is on hiatus. So passing it, they're going to have to do it in a special session, which is a whole other topic unto itself, because we mentioned the special session last week that they want to call for a different matter anyway, so that isn't such a problem.
Okay, so one more question. If, you know, in the last government, it was very clear why they put it into the bylaws that you have to pass a budget, because it gave Bibi the ability to then bow out of the government. You know, the only way that he could bow out without giving the prime ministership to Gantz at the time was by the budget falling. In this constellation of a government, where it's so important for all the parties just to keep it together, why would they put in the bylaws that not passing a budget would take apart their government? That's like sabotaging themselves.
Yes and no, because they needed to prove to themselves and to the people that they were doing this seriously, and they were, although they were once again this weird hybrid government, they were not the same type of government. They planned on getting things done. They could actually function together. So they set a time limit. And even when they set the time limit, they made it clear that they might push off the time limit by a certain amount of time if they were close but couldn't make it yet. They already passed most of these central parts of the budget, including, as we mentioned in the previous week, Chok HaHesderim, which is all of the different reforms that they're trying to get passed. Most of them are already in the stages of getting passed. Now, what's so important about this part of the budget is that this part was done separately from the rest. It was decided, I think we mentioned this last week, that it was decided by three people in a closed room that were all previously held the position of defense secretary. It was not voted on as a normal thing. And as we'll mention soon, a different part, a different law concerning the Haredis and them going into the army was held up as a result of this not being passed. So this was a very difficult thing, and especially since the party of Yamina, which is currently, I guess you could call them the ruling party, the prime minister is from this party, ran, and part of their platform was the army pensions had to be cut. We'll discuss soon why the army pensions have to be cut and what's the big issue with them, but it just to be clear that they can't, they're not just are they not cutting the pensions, they are raising the pensions substantially.
So my double question is, one, really, do we know the numbers? Like, how big does this, how is this important, influential is this, how much money are we talking about? And the second question to that is, and as a result of how much money, is this something that you really think this budget will fall on? Is this something that you really think that Gantz will definitely not give in on, or the other people will give in? How do you think this will move forward?
So I'll answer the second question first. It already passed. As in, like, it didn't pass the Knesset, but it already passed the vote of the cabinet and the ministers. And it already has essentially the support of the government, which means it has the support in the Knesset. Although with this government, that's always a difficult question that they have. Now, as to how much money it is, we do have all of the numbers, but before that, I want to mention one more thing. Why are the pensions important? Unlike a normal pension, you have what's called a constant pension, okay? They get this pension for the rest of their lives from the age of 42, from the day they leave the army, and it's a full, it's the exact salary. Whatever salary they were receiving, they continue to receive, regardless of whether or not they continue to work. For example, the defense secretary himself, I believe, receives more than one pension at the moment.
Yes, and I believe he receives about 17,000 shekels a month just as a pension from finishing the army, separate to his about 40,000 shekels a month for his ministership.
Right, and his actual pension itself has gone up to an insane amount and quasi-illegal amount that he even voted and suggested this matter because he might have a conflicting interest in this matter.
So I will jump in and say that I'm definitely consider there are issues with this, moral issues with this, and that there might be issues with, like, you know, him as being the head of the army and the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the IDF. But I don't believe that he's trying to pass this law to raise his own pension. Like, it's a little low to me to think that he's sitting there and saying, you know what, if I pass this law, I'm going to get a couple of thousand shekels a month more. I don't
know. Not him, but his friends.
I said, I'm not saying there aren't issues. I'm just saying I don't think it's a personal gain to his pocket that he's passing this law. But definitely to all the people that he knows in the past that were helping him. But, you know, to continue what you were saying was that in the end, this was an issue we've had for many, many years, okay? And then they actually changed this. This is a law that they changed a couple years back in which, you know, for example, when I was already in the army and I was in, you know, continued my duty after the mandatory service. So I was working for the army. I was getting a pension from the army. But my pension was, you know, it was better benefits than regular pension, but it was the same concept as it is in the normal workforce, which means I worked, a certain percentage of my salary was taken for my pension. Yes, the army gave a higher percentage of salary than in the regular private sector, but it was still within a proportion. And the longer you worked, the bigger pension you got when you got out of the army. That is different than what you are explaining, in which once you got to a certain point, you would get an automatic pension, which is a percentage of your salary for the rest of your life. That is something that was changed, and today it works differently. But this law that he passed is going to affect also the people before the law was passed and after the law was passed, and just give out a lot more money to those soldiers.
It was also changed mainly because they realized that if we didn't change it, the government would go bankrupt in a couple of years because it would become too big of a part of our budget. But we'll get to that a little bit later. One of the biggest critiques on this that he's really become like from Amit Segal, one of the right-wing columnists in Channel 12 News, he went on this whole rampage. He was saying he's not acting as the defense secretary. He's acting as a lobbyist. He's threatening to go with Bibi to a government just to get this passed and just so that his friends can get their money. And there's a lot of big critique in him. Now, let's delve into the numbers here because that's very important, okay? Now, The amount that they're asking to raise would end up costing, this is of course of different considerations into it, but each family in Israel, another 1,000 shekels a year for each family. Now that is a large amount of money, okay? Now also to go on to this, the average retirement age in the army is 46 for the people who are getting this. And when you take cops, for example, they have 54 and 59 in other members of the defense. And whilst in the rest of the population, it's 65, and it might raise soon. And the amount that they'd be getting a month for the average person leaving the army is 17,256 shekel, which is higher than almost anywhere else. And just to give you a comparison,
that's the pension.
That's just the pension.
That's higher than most people's salary in this country, substantially higher than most people's working salary.
Right. Most people in this country, the average is 8,953 shekel, according to, again.
And the median is about 11,000, which is more accurate to the people that work on day-to-day, but yeah, it's still substantially less than their pension will be.
And just how much this is of the general defense budget, it is 53% of the budget of the defense, and it is only going to rise in the coming years, and that's without the 1.5 billion shekel.
So what do you think they were thinking? What is his claim? What would he defend this? How would Bennett defend that they're agreeing to this?
Bennett's going to defend this a little bit later with how we're going to discuss who was saying he needed to get this passed to pass other things. And it's a hard defense and not one that can easily be accepted, but that's the defense that he's going to try to make. And there's another small number that I want to bring here because I saw this online. I even checked it afterwards, the math, to make sure that it was correct because it bothered me so much. If you were today to work every day of your every year of your life from the age of 21 and you were to every month put away 19,200 shekel for your pension with an interest of 4%, then you would maybe come close to having what they get for their pension. That's if you put away 19,200 shekel, which is, again, more than double the average salary of the person in Israel. Almost double the median average of the per salary of Israel, and that's just what you're putting away with an interest of 4%, which isn't such a high interest. But that's an insane amount of money that they're trying to pass. And the easy defense is that the defense that's always been on the news is you do not discuss the budget of defense. The budget of defense is above politics. Capitalism can't touch the budget of defense. I saw this online this week many, many times. And I'm sorry, no. The budget of defense has to be discussed. And especially since the people who are deciding, many members of the cabinet, six of them to be exact, could not vote on this because they have a conflict of interest. That's how bad this is get, because these are all the same people who are getting the same amount of money. It's their same friends, it's the same thing that they're helping out.
Okay, so you mentioned a few moments ago the deal about the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox community, and how this deal is dependent on that deal. Can you explain that further?
Yeah, so there's been a long time issue in Israel of the Haredi community not serving in the army. Now, to be fair, half of the population doesn't actually serve in the army, but that's a discussion for a different time. There's an issue is that they don't serve in the army, and the current deal is if they stay in yeshivas till the age of 24, they can then go out to work. Now, we're not going to discuss whether or not fairness, because we believe fairness to be irrelevant here. The issue is they are a big strain on the economy when they only start going out to work at the age of 24 with no education and no practical life experience. So part of what Bennett ran on and other parties ran to was lowering the age that they were allowed to go out to work to the age of 21. So they were saying, we're going to push them to go out to work, help them join the economy. And you're right, it's not going to be fair and it's going to suck for those who are going to go serve in the army, but it's going to help you in the long term for your financial gain. So they had to come to a compromise on this issue too, because Gantz would say, no, I am not lowering the age at all. So they came to a compromise with that, and that part of that compromise was passing this budget with the pension raise. So the compromise was that they're going to lower the age of them allowing them to go out to work to 21 for 1 year, then raise it to 22 the next year, and then raise it back to 23. I originally did not understand the logic behind lowering then raising, but the idea was that they are lowering it so that they can incentivize the community who doesn't want to go out to work as it is, seeing you can now go out to work, so that some of them at the age of 21, instead of waiting the 2 years, will say, I can go out to work if I go into the army, if I go into community service, so they might do that too.
So I am going to challenge some of the things that you said. I think the question of fairness is very important here. I think that the question of fairness, and again to specify it for our listeners, you know, you're talking about two parallel people, which are, you know, the same age, they go to the same education system, you know, each one in their different religious levels of education, but the same concept of the 12 years of education, they get to the age of 18, and then part of our population goes, serves for around 3 years in the army, getting basically no pay, living in the mud and the dirt, giving to the country, and another population which just skips that part and decides to do things that are good for themselves. Now, I'm very harsh about that. I think it's completely unacceptable, and I think that it's completely something that should be enforced on all populations. Now, you're going to jump forward and say, not all populations are good for the army. You know, you don't know what you're talking about. If you know how many of the ultra-Orthodox community goes to the army and then becomes not religious and Torah is the most important, I can accept all those things, but none of those things, none of them defend the people not giving national service. And that is the big difference, which is an opportunity and option that is given to many people. You know, many of the modern Orthodox girls in the country do not serve in the army for religious reasons, but they give a year to two of their life to work and volunteer in a hospital. They volunteer in schools and many, many different volunteer jobs, which are very hard to pay for, but they're serving the country. And that's something that's important for education and important for fairness. And I think that it's crucial in this situation, because what's happening here is that you're telling them, you don't have to go to the army. And if you don't go to the army, we're going to allow you to start working earlier, which is why we didn't allow working later. Now, let's also remember, they were always allowed to go work. You're allowed to go to a clothing store and work in a clothing store and get a salary as a clothing store. You're not allowed to open a business. You're not allowed to, there's many other things which are postponed from them.
I have to interject here, that's not true. If you are in yeshiva, you are not allowed to work during the time you are meant to be in yeshiva. If you are caught, you will get fined and most likely dragged to service.
No, I agree. So let me specify. If you are declaring yourself as learning in yeshiva, that's not the same declaration as getting out of the army, which people are able to do at younger ages. The Arab community as well does not declare that they are learning. They declare for many other reasons that are given and different other ways to get out of the army, and they get out of their service. Thank you for the correction. But what I would say is, and why this is crucial when it comes to importance, is that you have to get to a place where someone who serves in the army gets clear-cut benefits for the rest of his life. Now, the benefits are pretty, I have pretty simple solutions, and I'd love to hear from people where they're missing it. I don't understand why there's not a simple tax rate for people that serve. Now, there are for 3 years. Why is it 3 years? Why is it not very clear that one who serves full term in the army for the rest of his life will have a clear either tax cut or a different tax rate that he gets for him serving in the army? Or the other way around, you say to someone and say, when you're 21, you want to go work and you didn't serve in the army, there's no problem. You can work, because in the end, as you specified, I agree, people working is good for the economy for everyone. Everyone should be able to go work. You want to go work? Great. You're going to pay a lot more taxes for that work. Because if you didn't serve, you're going to give more to the country for that. And that's how I think it should be done.
So that's nice, and I agree with that. And I really do agree with the tax rate, and that's not a bad idea. The issue is, it's either this or we give them money. And in a very practical sense, it's like you take some disadvantaged communities in the States. You give them money, you give them programs to help them. This is the same idea. They're a supposedly truly disadvantaged community from their own fault. But they are, and you see this again and again through the generations, and it goes down to the next generation who become even more impoverished. And the idea is, we hopefully get you to go out to work, and then yes, you end up paying more taxes, and you have a better life, and that helps the economy in general, and yes, it helps the person serving in the army. And now, I'm not arguing against the benefits in the army, but part of the issue with this is that the benefits in the army are all structured wrong as it is. For example, one of the other things that we forgot to mention earlier that are currently passed was that they're lengthening, once again, the mandatory service. It was lowered this year to 2.5 years, and it's going back up to 2 years and 8 months. Now, it doesn't seem like a long time, but those 2 years and 8 months usually affect a full year of people's life with going to study in schools and universities. And why are they doing this? Because they need people in intelligence to stay, and they need people that fought in more military service to they can have them leave. The entire incentive structure in the army is backwards. I agree with you. That is irrelevant to at the moment. We need to deal with this populace so they go out to work and they go out and stop being just sucking out of the economy and start providing for the economy some sustenance.
So I agree with you. They should start working at 21 and they should immediately have another 2% tax rate on any money they make. That's not going to just does not work at all. And if you decide to work and you don't work, then you should stop giving those benefits. If someone is able to work and you told them, you don't have to hide that you're in yeshiva. From age 21, there are no more benefits. You can go work. And if you go work, you're going to pay more. And you know what? Even at age 30, if you go out, give 1 year of your life, I think it should be a lot more, but I'd say 1 year of your life to volunteer. Again, it's not really volunteering. You're still getting a salary, but it's in a volunteer program where it's obviously lower salary.
I'm sorry, you can't call that salary.
No, I'm saying it is volunteer work, but I'm saying even if you are parenting, you could even up the salary of volunteer work. But volunteer, understanding that you're going to a hospital to help for a year, after that year, not just will I give you 2% reduction on your tax rate, I would even retroactively give you back the money, the 2% that you paid since the age of 21 where you were working. So it even pushes you at any point to give to the country, and the country will give you back. And then it will also give a more fairness for those who serve in the IDF.
Or
the country in general.
I happen to agree with it. I think that's not a bad idea. And we'll see what they end up doing, because this is one of the specific laws, this lowering the age of service for the Haredis. We'll see if it ends up going through and what the repercussions will be. Because they're also putting some restrictions on it that a certain number of Haredis still have to go to the army, and they can't just go through and go out to work. And we'll really see what goes and happens with it. But it is important to add, whilst there isn't a governmental incentive for you to go serve in the army, there is a civilian one. There are a lot of people who would look to see what you did in your army service, or would look to see that you served in the army before hiring in this country. It's not that
fair. Not officially.
You're right. And it's not officially, and it shouldn't be officially. It's a populist thing, and it's part of a person's private decision if he wants to do that or not.
I mean, I hear that, but I officially, legally, had to go to the army. I didn't, wasn't convinced by the populace. I was told that if I don't go to the army, I will go to jail. Granted, I enjoyed my service very much, and my entire childhood was about the fact that I will get the schus and the opportunity to serve my country, but still wasn't an option.
That's true, and that's fair. And we might discuss that in a future episode where we discuss the idea of turning Israeli army into a more professional army instead of a draft. But we got to get on to other topics. Our next topic is a very sad topic. Last Friday evening, there was a soldier shot on the border of Gaza. He was a member of the Yamas unit, which is a unit of Israelis who disguise themselves as Arabs in order to protect and carry out military assignments. He was shot on the border through a Palestinian who ran up to the wall, stood under the wall, held up a handgun to the slit in the wall, and fired. As a result, there was a big political mess that ensued. Part of it was that the right attacked Bennett and others for not responding to the attack on the soldier immediately, mainly because of Bennett's trip to the States and because of another screw-up that Bennett performed that we'll discuss in a moment. Bennett called the family of the soldier at the hospital and messed up the soldier's name. When calling him, he confused the father of the soldier and the soldier himself's name when discussing it with the father. The father himself also was very adamant and attacked Bennett, calling him a coward and saying that he feared the Palestinians and that he wasn't protecting their soldiers or the people of the country. This, and afterwards, Netanyahu called the father. They had a very heartfelt conversation to juxtapose to Bennett's failed conversation. This led to a week of a lot of criticism from the right and from especially from the religious community where Bennett grew up in, that criticizing him for everything that happened down at the border.
Okay, so a lot happened here. First of all, this is tragic. For any of you who have not seen the video, rioters from the Gaza border standing there, and you can actually see in the sniper holes. There's these special holes in the border wall that you're able to sit and guard. And then basically you can literally see his gun coming out of it. And then you see these rioters come, hitting the gun, trying to pull away the gun. And then one riot comes in, sticks a handgun into the hole and shoots through the hole, therefore hitting and critically injuring the soldier that was on the other side of the border. It's an horrific failure to the protection of the border. And before we discuss, as Benjamin's mentioning, the political ramifications of it and what happened after, we have to understand that the main issue that you had here was that they were literally allowing people to be at the border. You know, when you see the video, there's hundreds of them that, you know, when you defend a border, you make sure that there's a various line, 100 feet, 200 feet, 1,000 feet, whatever you declare, in which you do not pass that line. That's where you stand. You pass that line, you get shot. You don't pass that line, we're obviously not here to, you know, just start shooting people at random, but you know that there's a certain border, and they did not protect that border, therefore allowing them to come all the way towards the border. And this was a big failure.
One of the biggest failures, especially was it published on the news, is why was this border collapsed and why were they getting so close to the actual wall? Because that there was no instructions to shoot. They were told they were not allowed to fire on the people getting close to the border. There was also conflicting commands from the current commander in the ground and higher ups in the military and civilian enforcement.
So this is an ongoing issue you have at the border. I mean, they don't riot every day, but every time we have these riots, it's the same statement. We come, they start rioting, they get violent, we defend ourselves and therefore shoot those who are dangerous. Then the news gets it that X amount of rioters were shot and killed, and then the whole media comes and attacks us for it. This is something that happens, cycle that happens every couple months. But the issue was here that, again, you can separate the fact that if there's someone dangerous and not dangerous, and that's true, you should not just be shooting anyone that's at these riots. Some people can be, like, you know, it is. I wouldn't say that the people that are going there to be peaceful at all. They're definitely there to throw rocks and as we're calling it, a riot and not a demonstration. But technically speaking, someone could decide to get up and say he wants to join this demonstration, not want any violence, and join this. But that is exactly why you declare a line, which is a distance from the border, saying if you pass this, you're by definition not demonstrating, you're not rioting, you're now endangering our border and endangering our soldiers, exactly for the example that happened right now, and shoot to kill order, very clear. Unfortunately, these orders are not given because we are scared of the PR and we're scared of the political ramifications, and therefore we do not stand strong enough on that border.
Well, yes, and now on to the actual political ramifications. As we mentioned, the phone call with the father was very hard to hear. This was serious attacks on Bennett and on his character, which led to a full week of attacks on Bennett from multiple angles. Another angle, which there was attack, was an attack on him from the settlements that are currently, as we mentioned, getting barely any building and almost being frozen. And we'll discuss soon Bennett's statements in the States, which led to even more mess on this exact matter.
So I think that what you're saying is true. But I think it was, you know, just one of those, just a bad move. You know, I'm not defending it. It was a mistake. I think that they overdid it and they made a mistake when a politician, you know, in the end, sometimes people forget what politicians are. In the end, a politician that is someone, especially the prime minister, but any politician is dealing with endless amount of people and some names. And, you know, and even this has happened to Bibi in the past. Bennett deserves to get attacked for this. It was a strategic mistake and also a tactical mistake. But when you call up someone and you have to remember, you know, the soldier's name, again, not defending him for making a mistake in my name, but that happens. That happens to any person. And it's a little, I just think it's more of like a weak thing. As if you were a rival to him and you're trying to attack his character, it's just a little bit weak to attack someone for mistaking the name when you are calling the father.
You're right, but the biggest mistake that he made was that the father even said to him, come down, visit us. The first thing he should have done after that phone call was get in the car and go see the family.
So yes and no. He's the prime minister. You don't know what other things he has going on. And again, it's so hard to even say the words that it's, you know, just a soldier that got critically shot. It's horrible. But in the end, he's running a country. And a soldier getting shot, it could mean I'm stopping everything and going there, depends. Or it could mean, look, I have the water budget to pass, this thing that I have to do, and another whole list of things, and I can't just drive down there to go to the hospital. And even more than that, especially because that would be just a photo op. I'll tell you even more than that. I think we'd attack him more if he did that. Because he made a decision, and this is what we'll discuss in a second. He made a decision, I am not attacking back for that. You know, they attacked a couple, nothing real, okay? They did the classic F-16s came up, they shot a couple different targets without killing anyone, and they ended it there. Now, as we're gonna discuss in a second, that was clearly a decision because of the summit that was happening, that was planned to meet with Biden, and therefore he did not want to heat up the border. That is a political decision that you can attack him for, but that's a decision. But once he decided he's not going forth on a strong fight there, what is he going to come show? Come show, oh, I'm so sorry you got shot, but I'm not changing anything from what's going on there? I think it was a correct decision. I'm calling you and I'm saying I'm very sorry. I'm giving you my support, but I also am dealing with the country right now and I have other things to deal with. I don't inherently see an issue with that.
So I do, but we'll leave that aside for the moment. Let's go on to the other attacks. As we mentioned, the settlements, the leaders of the settlements were attacking him fiercely for a pretty much a freeze on the building. There were 2,200 housing units that were overall approved, and his statements in the U.S. Bennett flew to the U.S., I believe, Tuesday evening, and he has met with the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense. He's done many interviews, and here comes the issue. He, on the one hand, was very clear that this government's not solving the Palestinian problem. They're not going for a huge peace plan or anything like that. They're not changing ideology. However, his statement was this, and I quote, "We're going to allow with the natural growth and progression of the settlements." Now that sounds great. We're going to continue allowing the settlements. However, historically, as we've seen in these parts, natural growth means, well, maybe approve 100 or 200 a year. It means no actual growth. It means going back pretty much the end to the middle of the Obama era to a complete freeze and choking of the settlements. This is what led to a massive criticism of him on the right. And even the heads of the settlements came to the airport to show him, we're serious. Like they came and they held up signs and they did a whole press conference there. It wasn't even covered on the news, but that's a whole different topic. But yes, they were showing strength against him because they're saying, you're going to meet with Biden now to show the fact that you are supposedly strong, you're for us. You were the leader of the Yesha Council, as you mentioned, which lead the settlements. And yet, this is what you're doing. What are you deciding before you're meeting with Biden?
One more thing I wanted to mention before I let you comment, Yonatan, is as the political landscape was so hostile toward Bennett this week, especially from the religious right, they decided to publish a picture of him and really push it online in the States. Now, this picture was a really great picture, and for those of you who want, it's going to be on our cover art this week, and you can take a look at it. It's a picture of him with tefillin on, praying before he goes out to see the Secretary of State and other American representatives. Why is this important? It's because he's reminding all of the people that are so critical of him on the news right now that are from the settlements and from the religious right, I am the first prime minister who wears a kippah. I am the least evil you could have. Yes, this government's not great, and yes, we have some issues, especially with a left-wing American administration, but I am for you. I'm one of you. It's trying to remind everyone that with all of their hatred towards him, they all used to love him 2 minutes ago, and if they just trust him to deal with things, it can end well for them. And it was a really good move, and we'll see what effect it has later in the week, but I think it was a good move for him at this point to try and show and remind everyone of who he is. Now, he can again screw this up by taking a flight back on Shabbos, but he won't do that most likely. So we'll see where this leaves us with it next week.
I think there's two separate parts to what you said there, and two separate parts to his speech. First of all, let's start with the fact that the statement that he made clear, which I think is crucial for the Biden administration and crucial for the next 3+ years to come, is a statement saying we are not planning to solve or create or deal with the Palestinians, with the two-state solution or anything, which is the easiest thing for Biden to say. Okay, and when he states that before he even arrives there, he's saying, let me be clear, we're not going into two-state solution, we're not solving this problem. It is, I think, a big statement to the administration. We're not even talking about it. Don't even put it on the table. It's not a conversation, which is the first thing Biden would want to push towards, is just this general thing of two-state and peace and push for it. So I think that was great, powerful, and a gutsy thing to do, and I'm proud that he did it. With that, to the second part, I 100% agree with you. I think that it's unacceptable, the building that's happening here. And I think that he is being weak on that part.
The lack of building, to be clear.
The lack of building, that's obviously it's happening. I'm going to give one twist option here. I'm not saying I'm not sure this is what I think, but there's another option here. Okay? He comes, he knows the summit's happening. Now, obviously, everything pre and coming to the summit is preparing yourself. What are the topics that are going to be discussed? Now, again, topics are obviously going to be Iran, Palestinian people, and therefore, it's always the conversation.
To be clear, the Israeli government has been attempting to force this summit to be almost entirely about Iran and almost no discussions on the Palestinians.
Exactly, which is why you don't want to discuss the building in the settlements, because that's the easiest topic for Biden to go for. You want to keep it Iran, and keep all the issues you're sitting. Now, one, you make a statement, I'm not dealing with Palestine, but what if, and this is an option I'm hearing here, what if his plan in the first place is to permit a lot more building soon? But he's saying, before I go to this summit, I got to make sure to keep the things on the down low. So I'm saying natural growth for both sides, and I'm really not approving too much, because if he'd approve right now thousands and thousands of buildings and things, that would be all over the news, we'd be attacked everywhere, and Biden would make that a main part of his conversation to slow down the building. Now I'm saying, let me get through the summit, finish it, and then in a couple months from now, it won't be tomorrow, in a couple months from now, start approving a lot more. Because then it's just a little Biden could say something, but we focused on what we focused on the summit. Now again, I'm stating, I'm not saying that is what his plan is, I'm saying it's definitely a possibility. And if it's a possibility, then it's good that he's not letting the gun under his skin and he's keeping it on a down low until the end of the summit.
The only question is, again, there's supposed to be between 30 to 35 minutes where they're discussing it just on their own. And the question is, in that conversation, assuming Biden is in any way coherent, what is that discussion about and how one-sided is that discussion? Is it, as we discussed last week, the American administration dictating to the Israeli government? Or is it, as allies, we're going to discuss and move forward on issues that relate to us both?
So I think it's in between the two. I don't think it's going to come down to a clear dictating, because I think that's exactly what I just said about what his speech before he entered it was, making it very clear, this is what is happening here. Now, again, I am no place saying that Biden won't pressure to have as much of a freeze of building as possible. I'm sure he will. But there's pressure and there's command. And Bennett made it very clear there's no commanding here. With that, I don't think it's going to be a friendly conversation in a, oh, Bennett, what do you think we should do? Give me some opinions. I don't think that's what it's going to be. It's going to be a strategic push for Bennett to be very clear. And you know what I think it is? I think it's going to be an attack conversation. I think it's going to be a very clear, I don't think it's about the deal. The deal's going to be discussed, but I think he has very little influence in the end. You know what? I think the deal's going to happen or not going to happen. It's going to be Biden's administration. And whether or not we can try to push off the dates a little bit or the details a little bit, I don't think that's what's going to stop or give Iran a nuclear bomb. I think the conversation is going to be a lot more forceful in what happens on due day. Okay? What happens when we need to attack? What is the plan? I'm not saying it's the plan when it comes to like how many planes, but is America in support? Are they going to allow us to make this act or not?
I think it's very nice. I honestly believe, especially with all of my research into the American political sphere at the moment, nothing will happen at that room in those 30 minutes. The main discussions already happened. As in, the main meeting was going to be with the Secretary of State. Politically, that's the most important one. Practically, the meeting with the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense were the important ones. In the end of the day, Biden isn't that... He is what he is at the moment, and I don't think those 30 minutes are actually making any difference on the policy-wise. I think the hours he spent with the Secretary of Defense and mean more.
Now, it's only a photo op?
Yes, I think it's maybe a photo op, and not necessarily. The meeting with all the advisors around will be more than the meeting with just the two of them. I don't think just the two of them is any way of a practical meeting with these two people. That doesn't mean between just a president and prime minister can't be. I think it's with these two. It's not such a practical meeting. It's more of a meeting to, in theory, attempt to set up a repertoire between the two of them of a sort of discussion so that they can have some side of discussion where this isn't Trump and this isn't Netanyahu. This isn't the people who have been around for the last 4 years. These are new players in the field. They need to have some sort of relationship when it comes to these type of things. Now, the political issue on this is a little difficult because... sadly, there was an attack in Afghanistan where multiple people were killed, which may lead to American issues on going back in or retrieving their own members, but that's a discussion for a different time, which led to the summit being pushed off. Now, the question is, first of all, how bad does this look for Bennett? Because A, Bennett went there, he sat at the White House, he was ready for the summit, he either way had to wait for the president because the president waits for no one. And then he was just sent back to his hotel. That photo, whilst for all the good reasons, like horrible reasons, but practically viable reasons, it's not a good look. It's you were kicked out of the White House, you're sent home. That wouldn't happen to Netanyahu.
So I don't agree with that last statement. I agree with everything you said to the last statement. Look, I think it's, I don't want to say bad luck because it's not a matter of luck, but that's what happens. And you know what, I think that it's twofold. I think that everyone that was involved with it was like, oh, what a shame. Oh, that doesn't look good for the Israeli prime minister. And at the same time saying, that's what we expected to happen. It makes sense to happen. It's just unfortunate. I don't think this is a big deal. I don't think it was I'm not interested in meeting with you. They rescheduled the summit as soon as possible. But in the end, it was an idea of, yeah, something tragic just happened at least four. At the time of that they pushed it off, American soldiers, Marines were killed, and many Afghanis, but four Marines were killed. That's a reason that you need to stop and really push things off, and it's an unfortunate, legitimate reason. No, it does not look good. It's not how Bennett wanted to finish his trip, but that's also what happens.
It's also important to note this pushes off his coming back to Israel. the actual act of the summit itself and the discussions we'll have to discuss next week, because it's only happening Friday afternoon, and therefore we won't be able to discuss it this week. But again, going into this, I don't see what Bennett hoped for as the picture with the president, giving him more legitimacy. And even from Biden's side, from Biden wanting a strong ally who does need American support, either Taiwan or Israel or such countries, neither one of them can get what they need out of this summit anymore, because they both ended up looking weak just by the summit itself.
I agree.
Speaking of death, our next topic is about a member of Knesset who died this week of a heart attack. His name is Alhomi. He is an Arab member from Ra'am. He is a very important member, because he was the member who decided to abstain from the vote of forming a government, because he had many issues with it. And as such, he has been a thorn in the side of this government since it formed and causing them many issues. Whilst the person replacing him is a lot more radical on her philosophies, on her voting record, she tends, and her what we believe she'll do as part of the government, she has been a lot more supportive of this government. He's also was the member who was in charge of all the illegal building in the down south. And whilst it's bad, it's not really politically correct to say that because he died, it's convenient for this government. Yes, it's very convenient for the coalition that he's now being replaced. This 49-year-old that died of a heart attack was now being replaced. We'll also get in a minute to the actual politicians who reacted to his death.
So I think that you said it very correctly. You know, look, it's not... He didn't deserve to die. The man did nothing illegal as a person, and he was a Knesset member like any other member of Knesset and deserved all of those rights and deserved to be buried with all the respect of any other Knesset member. With that, in the end, we're a political podcast, and there's political ramifications for anything. And definitely there are political ramifications which are positive for this government, as unfortunate as it is to pass away that way in such a young age. It is positive for this government.
So some of the political reactions, there were obviously many tweets about like saying the sad for his death and whatnot, and a lot of people were calling up old tweets of Bennett's and, that were criticizing this person. But there's one specific post I wanted to react to. This is from MK Simcha Rothman from the Religious Zionist Party, that he stated that, I'll quote, it's not very long, Alhomi was not a friend of mine, and he was not even something close to that. He did not, there was nothing that was with us that could be bridged somehow, because he denied my very existence. And that is why at this hour, I will not paint him in a good light, and I will be sad for his death. I went as far away from this person as possible. He was a politician that dealt with the delegitimization of us in a systemic way, and with many members of this house, and with many members of the Jewish nation. Now, he goes on to say, because people bashed him, that this was not a text that he wrote. He wanted to prove a point here. This is a text that this was the text of the speech was written about someone else. This text was written by an Arab member of the Knesset after Rehavam Ze'evi, who was the minister.
Gandhi.
Rehavam Ze'evi Gandhi, he was murdered. He was the minister of terrorism. And this was written by an Arab member of Knesset at the time. And he was saying, you do not get to just pick and play games because I said something. It is therefore horrible. But when he said this, no one didn't deign to react.
I think that it's a two-sided sword where both sides are wrong. I think that when it comes to someone dying, first of all, I don't think you should just paint everything positive and everything in light. No, I think that there's a nice balance there. You know, I think that if you asked me, you know what, I think I said it right now, and this is exactly what I just said on this podcast. I think that him passing away is unfortunate, and it is a sad thing because he passed away from a heart attack at a young age. That doesn't change the fact that there were many issues with him and that this could make the coalition stronger. And those are two very separate things. And I think that that's where he failed to do that, or he and the person he was quoting. You know, when he started off a sentence, I was trying to say, I have no problem all around. I think it's almost hypocritical to say, what an amazing guy, and we worked so great together. No, I think a beautiful sentence is saying, I totally disagreed with you. We were on different sides of the aisle. We did not speak a lot, or whatever it is, that's the truth. but I'm very sorry that you died. And I don't think that you should die at a young age. And that should be the statement. And if you do think that he should have died to solve your political issues, then I have a problem with that. Then I think you should be bashed for that. Now, the one more thing I'm going to say is, by his quote, I think on the one hand, brilliant move by him. Very powerful to show that that was true. But I'm going to sum up and say, just because when they did it, they didn't attack it, does not make it right now. It was wrong then, and it's wrong now.
You're right, and but it was a very good political move, because he does go on in his thing to say that it's not necessarily about this person. He was saying, this person is bad, and everything that happened with him is bad. He was just saying that this was just a bad person in general, which is a fair argument to make, seeing as this is a person who had supported terrorism any time and had been advocating multiple times for the destruction of Israel, but it was not a great political move.
And for the dumb economic decisions of the week.
So we discussed this already last week, the Israeli flight company, and yes, thank you for all of your lovely comments. We learned that a flight company is called an airline. We just could not remember this last week. The Israeli airline El Al is going to be bailed out for 150 million shekel. And this happened partially as a result of them blocking the prime minister's plane from taking off when he was flying to the States, all of the workers there. And I want to correct myself a little last week. I stated I was very against this, but I did see one fair argument. I'm not saying this should still be done. I still think it's a very bad idea. There was a fair argument. One of the reasons that this time that El Al is going under is that they were forced to still run, but they couldn't run any of their flights that went to good countries. The countries were being shut down. You're not allowing flights back and forth, or you're telling people you shouldn't fly, you shouldn't fly, you shouldn't fly. Seeing as the government is the one hurting this company, they're saying it's only fair that you should help us out. Now, I'm not making this argument, nor do I even agree with this argument. I was just saying it was an interesting argument that I heard.
So I think that my main issue is the proportions. I understand, again, I have many issues with El Al in general and all that we discussed before, but even if what you're saying is true and this is a specific situation where they should be allowed to, going to the prime minister when he needs his plane to take off to go meet with the president of the United States to deal with Iran, and you're trying to make a scene there to block because you're having some economic issues. Like, there's some things that I could say that could be done, but that's just an inappropriate measure for your issue that you're having. And now we'll move on to our final segment, Fun Israeli Facts of the Week.
We have two facts for you this week. The first one involves the Olympics. So the Paralympics started this week, and mazal tov to the Israeli Arab who won a gold medal in swimming, I believe. I do not remember his name. And the second fact is that although Israel's landmass is mostly desert, we have a bobsled team who is not half bad, apparently.
So, first of all, that is a very interesting fact. I did know that. I feel like I've heard in the past about our bobsled team that bobsleds on sand because they have no ice or snow anywhere, basically.
So it reminds me of that movie of the Jamaican bobsled team.
That was a good movie. And now I will just say before I go to the second fact that really it's a pretty amazing achievement in the Paralympics. Shalbi, the Muslim from Shfaram, was actually born deaf. And when he was 13 years old, he was in an accident and since then is paralyzed from the waist down. And really, you know, it really is a big achievement, and it was pretty incredible to see when he actually won. You to be able to understand that he won, he had to turn around, and then you see his reaction once he figures out that he won. So it is pretty incredible, and good for him. The second interesting fact about Israel for the week revolves, winter is coming. Soon we are approaching it, and Crembo is going to return. Now, I'm sure that all of our listeners know what Crembo is, the Israel-only incredible chocolate mold of cream puffs. But the interesting fact about Crembo is, first of all, it is only made 4 months of the year where they actually manufacture the Crembo and is being sold. And the more interesting part of it is that the Israeli government actually takes Crembo and freezes it for certain situations, okay? It's so interesting that this is actually something that's done, but there are certain situations with that have been in the past with pregnant women that specifically wanted Crembo, and then they were able to supply them with Crembo that is frozen throughout in those months that don't have it. And it's actually a true thing that they put it aside because it's literally not manufactured most of the year. And every single Crembo that is made is actually wrapped by hand. If you've ever seen a Crembo, it's wrapped in a tin foil. There are no machines to date that are able to be so delicate with the puff to wrap it by machine. And therefore, they are, after the chocolate is put on, they wrap each one by hand. And with that, we will conclude our episode. Packed episode this week, a lot of information. We hope you enjoyed. Thank you for listening. We remind you, you could email us at hwga.pod@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week. This is Here We Go Again.